from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Berkeley-based writer and attorney Ayelet Waldman joins us in the Forum Hour ahead to talk about her recently published essay collection, Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. We'll discuss why she calls herself a bad mother and find out what she means by the bad mother label, as well as get responses from her on the strong responses that have resulted from some of her writing. We'll also talk with her about her friendship and support with her husband, novelist Michael Chabon, of President Barack Obama, and about her personal agonies of having gone through an abortion. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. No one could accuse Ayelet Waldman of having an absence of what she writes of getting from her mother, chutzpah. Ayelet Waldman's mother was a feminist in an unhappy marriage who impressed many lessons on her daughter, including a major one of not getting entrapped in an unsatisfactory marriage and of finding one's way to a productive and gratifying career. After a marriage that failed in large part because her first husband was too passive, Ayelet Waldman fell in love at first sight, by the way, and to what she describes as her good fortune with Michael Chabon. And she describes him Jewish, successful, smart, and funny. In her recently published book, Bad Mother, she writes about love and marriage and career, but most of all about mothering and about her own struggles with the June Cleaver image of good mother and her feelings of being, by contrast, and especially when she makes a decision to have an abortion, a bad mother. Her 18-chapter book, Bad Mother, is subtitled A Chronicle of Maternal Crimes, Minor Calamities, and Occasional Moments of Grace. The author of Daughter's Keeper and Love and Other Impossible Pursuits, her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Salon.com, New York, Elle, and Vogue. A Harvard-educated lawyer, she and her husband make their home with their four children in Berkeley, and she joins us for this hour in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
But I have to correct one thing.
Please.
I was not married to the passive Israeli that I was with for 6 years, We never got married. And I don't want to let my children, if my children hear this, they'll have like complete heart attacks.
I think you kept something from them and you've kept nothing from
nothing.
We'll talk about. But
thank goodness we never got married.
I'm sorry I misspoke on that score. Here's something, though. I'm looking at a blog I think you sent out. It says, here's a link to my appearance on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. I know, it's pretty sleazy to send this out, but honestly, it was one of the absolute highlights of my life. I've been carrying on fantasy Fresh Air interviews since my first book was published in my car, in the shower. Forget the Oscar speech. All I ever wanted was this. And I thought, what am I, chopped liver? No. But you did get on Terry Gross, and you talked about, and we'll talk about it here as well, a very difficult subject, rocket ship.
Yes, that it was a second trimester abortion that we had, which is even more, I talked about it on Terry Gross, and that interview was before the murder of George Tiller. And since that time, I've written quite a bit about it and have been even more open.
Have you had a lot of the kind of negative reaction you had to some of the other things that you've been public about in terms of your private life?
It's really interesting. I've had, I'm sure if you go out on the internet, you'll find people in the pro-life movement who are very upset by it. I got only very few of those emails. And the ones that I got were by and large very, very thoughtful. There were people who took issue with my decision. A couple of emails from people who either had, brothers with Down syndrome or children who with mental disabilities who, challenged my decision to abort based on that. And a couple of emails from people who were religious and just felt that they needed to let me know that I had made the wrong choice. But I also got hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of emails from people who had made the same choice. A couple who were listening to the Terry Gross interview they were on their way home from Planned Parenthood after a termination of a baby that they had very much wanted due to the termination was due to genetic problems, and they pulled over by the side of the road and just listened to the interview and cried. And I got two very disturbing emails from women, independently separate women, who wrote to tell me that they had made the opposite choice. They had kept their babies, and that both of these women wrote that they regretted it terribly. And that those letters were just tragic. I mean, that they felt that they could, that they, they needed to write that to someone they'd never met. And they signed their names, too. Those broke my heart.
Well, part of your decision was really, I mean, one of the major catalysts was talking to a woman who had gone through giving birth and who said, I love him and he's wonderful and everything, but I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah, I called this woman out of the blue. I mean, really out of the blue. I got her name out of the phone book. I had traced her via a research study that was done on the specific genetic abnormality that our baby had. And woke her up early in the morning in New York City. I think it was 5 o'clock my time, so maybe even 4 o'clock. So it was she was feeding breakfast to her family, and she very generously spoke to me. I was looking for more information about the specific genetic variation to find out if she knew anything more than had been in the study. And she said that there was no more information than had been in that study, and that she that was all the research that was done. But that she wanted me to know that she had a child who was mentally retarded, who she loved, who was the center of her life, she said, who she adored. And she said that had she the opportunity to make that the same decision that I was facing, she would have chosen to abort.
The writing that you do on this subject, I mean, very personal and very poignant. And also, I imagine, particularly for someone who's been most of her adult life, all of her adult life, and maybe even before, a pro-choice advocate and activist, difficult to say the kinds of things that you said, because you were, again, kind of shaking up some shibboleths. You were saying it's felt like a baby, not like a fetus or a bunch of cells like your mother tried to tell you. And you felt like you were, in effect, killing.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I think that we are at a point in the discussion about abortion where people who have any kind of, you know, emotional and intellectual maturity, most people in the world, need to have this conversation in a way that isn't as simplistic as we've had it before. I think the simple-minded conversation that, you know, ends up with Bill O'Reilly and the man who murdered George Tiller. And I think those two are very, very closely connected. But
I'm
not
alone there by any means.
Yeah, no. But I do think that but I think we in the pro-choice movement, unless we're willing to confront the truth of abortion, we can't win the debate. And the truth of abortion is that, you know, in the world of now four-dimensional ultrasounds, I didn't even know there was a fourth dimension, but four-dimensional ultrasounds, everybody knows exactly what the fetus looks like. When you're pregnant with, you know, when you're pregnant with a baby that you want, it's a baby at a week and a half gestation, you know, and we really need to, I think it's only when we accept the truth and acknowledge responsibility for our decisions that we can at the same time expect that those decisions be honored and that our right to make those decisions be honored. But it's muddy, you know? I mean, it's muddy. I ended up doing a discussion on Slate.com with Elizabeth Weil, who also had who also terminated a baby for genetic reasons. And we were you know, you start to go down that road.
Elizabeth's a former intern, in fact.
Oh, really? Oh, great. But, you know, you go down that road and then you find yourself in the awkward position of feeling a little bit like, you know, like a proponent of eugenics. Because what am I saying? Well, am I really saying that babies with Down syndrome have no right to live? No. But I am saying that someone who is pregnant with a baby with Down syndrome has a right to end that life. So so the conversations they're not easy. They're very painful.
I had one a number of years ago with two women who did a study of the after effects of abortion on women throughout the country. And there were a number of callers who didn't like what they were hearing, because what they were hearing was, and these were pro-choice women, what they were hearing was there's post-traumatic stress, there's all kinds of guilt, there's self-recrimination. In fact, it made me think of, do you know a poem called The Abortion by Anne Sexton?
No, I don't.
It's an extraordinary poem, because what she's saying is it's not like, you know, you're changing your shoes, you're feeling like you've taken a life. And she was writing about it in a way that I thought was really quite vivid, especially for its time. And she titled it The Abortion. And as you say in your book, there's too much of an unwillingness to use that word.
Right, exactly. I mean, particularly women who've gone through the experience that I went through, they, you know, there was a website that I participated in called A Heartbreaking Choice. And we were to refer to the – and this I cannot say enough good things about the website and the women who started it and what an amazing service they provide and a sense of community for people who feel at the most, you know, desperately alone. But the way the experience was referred to on that website was my AHC, as in my A Heartbreaking Choice. And I got, you know, pushback because I refused to use that word. I insist on using the word abortion. And the reason I do is because if we opt out of the word abortion, If we say, oh, you know, we didn't, what we had was different, then we lose the right to abortion. And, you know, guess who's going to lose it first? Those of us who had these second trimester abortions. You know, there was a woman in one of my support groups who was a pro-life Catholic who got permission from her priest to abort the baby who had very, very severe, severely affected baby with Down syndrome. Most not incompatible with life, but certainly incompatible with, you know, anything beyond a vegetative state. But she was pro-life and she remained pro-life. And I always thought that was, you know, that she was a lovely, wonderful woman. But part of me wanted to just shake her and say, you know, wake up. How could you be pro-life how could you not allow other people to make the same choice that you made?
There's even a good deal of consternation, always has been, about the semantics of using terms like pro-life or pro-choice, for that matter. We're talking with Ayelet Waldman, by the way. Her book is Bad Mother. And after the abortion, those of you who knew her from the Mommy Mysteries, the Mommy Track Mysteries, those stopped. And then a writing career commenced. But let me go back with you a bit, because you go into your book about another very difficult choice. You're working as a lawyer. You're loving it. You're eating it up, you know.
Wearing my little Ally McBeal skirts. Yes. You know it.
And in fact, it reminded me of a line of a cousin of mine who said, I'd rather litigate than fornicate. And that's not necessarily true for you, but especially with Michael. But, you know, here you were.
Well, if it's a really good trial, I don't know. It's like, yeah, it's hard to decide.
Well, you're loving it, and yet they're feeling that sense of, I should be with my kids. I should be doing the Gymboree mommy thing and all that. And that's a very tough kind of divide.
Yes. And with me, it was that. And I was also feeling like, look, I was jealous of Michael for doing all those things with Sophie. That's my oldest. But I was also jealous of Sophie for getting to hang out with Michael all day. And this life that they were living seemed so bucolic and marvelous to me, you know. There they woke up and they, you know, Michael would do these costume changes all day long. He'd dress her up and then he'd take her picture and then he'd change her outfit and take her picture again. And they would go to Mommy and Me and they would go out to lunch with their girlfriends and they would do all these wonderful things. And I thought, I want to do that with them. I want to do that. That sounds so much fun. And, you know, and it is like, you know, the big secret truth is, you know, I have a good friend who's a former partner at a big law firm. I'm not going to name the firm because you'll be able to identify her. But we always talk about how the secret truth is, guess what you don't get to do when you're working as a full-time attorney? You don't get to, you know, after the kids go off to school, sit and read the New York Times for an hour. And that hour, honestly, it's hard to decide whether it's worth, you know, losing your entire career, but it's kind of up there.
I think
it's a
the
good
key word
newspaper.
You use is monotony. It's crushingly boring. Or
yes,
can be.
It can be. Yeah. It really can be. Well, especially babies. I mean, I love babies. I actually, infancy is my favorite time. I love a kid who can't talk back. I love, you know, the sort of smushy adorableness of babies. But there really is nothing more lonely than being alone with an infant.
You've written about these kind of feelings and have been very open about them, and you include some responses, some venomous responses that are anonymous to some of the things that you said.
That's my favorite part of the book is I decided I was going to put in some hate mail. And I have too thin skin, which is sort of ridiculous when you're you have such a big mouth as I do. Like, you shouldn't be so sensitive, but I am very sensitive.
Comes from playing dodgeball as a kid.
You go. Exactly. So I don't ever read hate mail. And in fact, I don't Google myself. I don't read reviews unless somebody, you know, I read the New York Times review, But I would never find all this hate mail. And if something comes into my email box, I'm very good at figuring out in the first like two words whether it's crazy hate mail. Constructive criticism I'm fine with, but crazy hate mail I just delete. But I had to go Googling for this stuff in these comments pages on the website for all these crazed comments about me. And at the remove that it was, you know, a few years later, it was actually really fun. People say incredibly horrible things.
It's amazing how, especially with the anonymity of the internet, they can flame and flame with a sense of impunity that things that they wouldn't do face to face. But I'm curious to know something. I mean, you have many people admire you for your honesty and for your boldness and for the way that you've opened up your public life, I mean your personal life in a public way. But you've talked about your sex life, you've talked about drug use, you've talked about loving your husband more than your kids, about maybe even regretting the fact that a son, or hoping that one of your sons could be gay, so
yeah,
that he could
go shopping.
Yeah,
I'm still hoping. I got one, you know, my
you
older son,
more,
alas, is heterosexual, but I have one in the pike that, you know, could
you got
go
more gay
way.
Men, I think, mad at you than anything else when you said to go shopping with
a
me.
A couple, but everybody, you would, most of the gay men were right on board with it.
Well, the
it's
kind
such
of,
a waste a, for me not to have a gay son or a lesbian daughter. I mean, it really is. It's like, here I am with just waiting for someone to come out so I can throw them a party, and it's probably not going to happen. Although, you know, anything could go on with Abraham. He's only 6.
Well, there's still hope for him, I guess, in that sense. But you've gone public about your own bipolar struggles, which some people think that sort of information shouldn't be privy to your children. I'm wondering, regrets about all this openness and honesty?
Oh, well, you know, first, bipolar disorder, that absolutely has to be privy to your children. I mean, I think when I was growing up, my father's bipolar, and he had not been diagnosed. And my whole family was bipolar because of this. You know, we cycled right along with him, and he was what's called a rapid cycler. So one morning, everything was great, and we had enough money, and we were in a wonderful place, and he had a great job, and everything was joyful, and we were all up and happy. And the next day, calamity was right around the corner, and he was going to get fired. You know, this is all in his mind, right? And we just cycled along with him and felt as vulnerable and as crazy as he did. And as soon as we had a name for what he had, as soon as we understood it, it made a huge difference to my mom, to all of us. So my kids are well armed with the idea that that their mother is bipolar, that it's a disease. It's like diabetes. You take your medication and you mostly keep it under control. And they also know that if I start to lose it, it has nothing to do with them. They didn't cause it. They aren't part of it. It doesn't. It's the disease, not us as a family. And I think that's really important to be open about.
But do they need to know that you are in love with your husband and love them, but would suffer more if your husband suffered,
yeah,
God forbid, a fatality as opposed to your children? Or do they need to know that you did ecstasy and your sex life? These kinds of things, really.
Yeah, well, you know, they knew about that stuff, about loving Michael, having Michael be the sort of center of my marriage, and, you know, like loving Michael more than them. I mean, they were so not surprised. My oldest daughter just kind of rolled her eyes and said, duh. I mean, they know all about that. I mean, the thing that gives them a sense of security in the world is knowing that their parents aren't going to split up. I mean, every year, you know, you get more and more of those. The school directory comes back, and more of the kids have 2 addresses. And my children have this deep sense of security that their parents aren't going anywhere, that that we love each other is really deeply comforting to them. I say that now. Maybe they're all planning their memoirs. Who knows? Some of the other stuff. I mean, there are things that in retrospect I wish I hadn't written about.
Are there boundaries?
Yo, there are lots of boundaries. You know, it's so funny when you write memoir, because in a way you are constructing this character. I mean, even if you're being very, very honest, you are constructing – it is a character. And
it's on the page.
Yeah.
So you can't
communicate. And there are lots of things that I don't – there are many, many things that I would never write about or talk about. You know, one of the things is I would never say anything horrible about my husband or children in print. I remember once being part of this anthology, and there was a very good essay written by a woman who clearly loathed her husband, and it was to whom she was still married, and it was written anonymously, but you know, you couldn't not know who wrote it, and if you knew her, if you knew anyone in her circle, and that for me was just beyond the pale. Not that it was beyond the pale for her, but like I could never do that, and you know, that's really my major line in the sand. I'm pretty much always willing to reveal anything that makes me look bad, but I'm not willing to reveal stuff that makes my family look bad.
Is it more masochistic to do that, or is it more narcissistic, some would ask? Or
both.
Is it both?
It's masochistic, it's narcissistic, it's bipolar disorder and having no internal, you know, censor. It's, you know, but I get most of my email, most of my mail comes in and it says, thank you for saying what I was afraid to say, which really is, thank you for saying what I had the good judgment to keep my mouth shut about. And it serves a purpose for, you know, when you're feeling awful about something or guilty or ashamed, if you read, I know for me, when I read an essay by someone or a novel or wherever that experience, I realize is if not universal, then at least not completely unique to me. It's very comforting. So, you know, it serves a purpose that I provide that comfort.
But you also got a lot of women angry at you. I guess an Oprah woman lunged at you and said, let me at her. But also, I'm thinking,
she didn't lunge at me. She lunged at the stage. where I was.
It wasn't the Jerry Springer moment.
No.
Okay.
No, it was, and it was before they started taping, but it still freaked me out completely. Yeah, that was a nice moment.
But there are a lot of women, just from judging from what I've read in your book, who probably find it very threatening because you're saying to them, look, your husband's not, implicitly, subtextually, your husband's not doing enough, so you probably resent him. You've transferred more of your libido onto your kids and more of your feelings onto your kids, and that's why your marriage is dried up in terms of sexuality. I mean, these are things that women don't necessarily want to hear.
Oh, you know it. Yeah, I mean, and they really, what they really don't want to hear is, hey, your husband just sent me an email asking, you know, how he can get some action, you know, like, which is, happens all the time. But, yeah, you know, I think that was really, really true 4 years ago. But something happened with this book. I have gotten almost no – I mean some, I'm sure, negative pushback. Like I said, I don't Google. But I have gotten such positive response to this book. And I
– You've become institutionalized, maybe.
Maybe. That's – but I actually think we're in the middle of a backlash. I think we're – or maybe not in the middle of. We're at the very beginning of a backlash against this crazed, compulsive – parenting. I have this theory that really what happened is, you know how Jews control the world? Well, I think we like infected the entire world with our Jewish mother psychosis, like a virus. It spreads.
It's a meme.
Yes, exactly. So suddenly the whole world was a Jewish mother hovering and obsessed with her children and, you know, desperate for them to get 800s on their SATs. And anyway, but now I think there's like a vaccine. That I'm the vaccine to that. But I think there really is this kind of backlash against it. I think that we're seeing more and more, you know, websites about bad mothers and books, you know, the three martini play date or whatever, that kind of thing is becoming more acceptable.
And then you got Michael Lewis, your Berkeley fellow resident, who was just here last week talking about fathers doing more, but
poor
all the inner
Michael.
Life, the interior
poor
life.
Michael. It's so hard for those dads, isn't it? You know, they have to do everything. They have to earn the money. Their wives have it so easy. Yeah. Let's not go there. I do think that
you do have boundaries after all.
Yeah, I have boundaries. I like them. Maybe that message, I think.
We need to talk about here because we're coming up on a break. You're still thrilled with Obama's victory?
Yeah, I'm still thrilled. I have my problems. You know, I got my issues on my checklist that have not been checked off, and I'm kind of getting a little impatient.
Especially where maybe people of the same sex are
concerned? Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. The Defense of Marriage Act. I was as appalled as a lot of people were by that brief. I just didn't understand why it had to be so good, right? Why it had to be so convincing. I got that I would have been willing to accept the brief that said, well, you know, this is our government, you know, this has been our position at the Justice Department and we need to support our position for whatever reason. I would have been able to swallow that, but the brief that they wrote goes down very, very, very bitter. And I think, I mean, why are we still pushing footing around this don't ask, don't tell? Nobody wants it anymore. The country doesn't want it. The military doesn't want it. I really honestly think Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh are the only people who still want it. And, you know, it's about time to jettison that.
Coming up on a break, like I said, I've got to get your response to a quote, though, because I was looking at an interview you did at USA Today and you were asked, any advice for new moms? And here's what you said. Nothing you do to them can damage them forever. There's no mistake you can make that can ruin their life short of boiling their heads in a vat of pasta. If you have that perspective, then you can forgive yourself your errors. Just give yourself a break. Do you mean that literally, though? There's nothing they can do to damage them? I mean,
well,
short of physical
like
abuse.
Short of physical abuse. Yeah. I mean, I think you can make them neurotic, like my, you know, or you can help participate in their neuroses. I don't know if my mother made me neurotic. I just like to blame her for stuff. I mean, but really, you know, I really do believe that the children, they're incredibly resilient. They are hatched with
Hold that thought. Okay. I'm going to give the phone number and invite those listening to join us. It's toll-free. If you'd like to talk to Ayelet Waldman, please join the program. 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. We're spending the hour with Ayelet Waldman. Her book is called Bad Mother, A Chronicle of Maternal Crimes, Minor Calamities, and Occasional Moments of Grace. And she'll be appearing at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley tonight at 7:30 p.m. and in San Francisco at Congregation Sherith Israel on Monday, June 22nd at 7 p.m. and at Book Passage in Corte Madera on Tuesday. I think that covers at least some of the local appearances for a while. Yeah, we're going to go to your calls here. In fact, let me do that, and we'll begin with Carol from Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm 57, and I had an abortion 35 years ago. And I've never had kids, which I have some regrets about, but I've never had a moment's regret about the abortion. It never was I was single. I didn't have any money. There was no question I was going to have it. And I understand that there are situations, especially later term, where the complications, and we have to be honest about, you know, the complications and the nuances. But I just wanted to say that the, quote, stereotypic pro-choice position that you can have one and have no complications also exists.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I had a similar abortion when I was not in a position to, and it was very early, and I didn't lose a wink of sleep over that. I really didn't. I mean, I had exactly the reaction that my mother wished I'd had with a later one.
But in the book, you regret, I mean, you express ongoing regret to some degree. It's vestigial almost,
yeah.
That's the way I read you.
No, it is. You know, in the chapter about Rocket Ship is the name that Zeke had given the baby. We were sort of batting around names for him. And as a joke, Zeke named him Rocket Ship, and we had been calling him that. And that's sort of the name that lasted. And we'd planted this tree that I write about in the book. And when I wrote the book, the tree
had plum tree.
A plum tree. The tree had just burst into bloom and fruited for the first time in about, I guess it was almost 7 years. And it was this very symbolic, wonderful thing. And just as I was finishing that chapter, the plum tree fruited and we ate the fruit and it was so sweet. And
you know that poem of William Carlos Williams about the plum being left and he eats
yes,
it?
Yes, exactly. But then the tree died this year. It just died. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, Michael and I were both totally devastated. I mean, we just cried and cried. I mean, over many days. And it had, you know, it had nothing to do with, I mean, I like the tree. It was a nice tree, but it was clearly that it just brought that up. And I ended up having to sort of sit down and create this story in my mind about how it died because I didn't need it anymore. And because I wrote this chapter and I kind of confronted all of that pain and now I was ready to move on. And we just planted – the city of Berkeley, God bless the city of Berkeley, just planted 3 little fruit trees for me on my medium strip. Like, and they asked me exactly what I wanted. I told them I wanted fruit and I want them to flower pink in the spring. And they – and you know, I will never, ever say a word against the city government of Berkeley after that.
Never say never about not
I know.
Crossing City Hall. Alexandra, join us. Good morning. Alexandra?
Yes, hi, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say something about, first of all, thank her for dealing with the topic of abortion, which is a very difficult thing to do. And I had an abortion myself. And the one thing that I wanted to say was that I am pro-life. And I think that actually all women mostly are pro-life. And the fact that we decided to stop a pregnancy and to have an abortion for whatever many reasons that we may have doesn't mean that we're not pro-life. And I really have an issue with the fact that we cannot be considered pro-life when we are. I think nobody in the whole world really wants a child to die. And I just wish that would be settled also when we choose. I would choose always to vote and I would always support a woman. I'm sorry, I'm emotional right now. I support a woman to having an abortion. And from that place, I am pro-choice and I will vote for pro-choice. But we are all pro-life. That's all I wanted to say.
I think that's really lovely. And I try to remember not to use those language, you know, not to. Naming is so important, and I always try to remember to say anti-choice and invariably fail. It's like, you know, I just keep thinking about this. You know, none of us call the Somali pirates the Somali Volunteer Coast Guard, which is what they call themselves. We don't give them the power of that name, right? So why do we – I mean, and not to equate people who are anti-choice with Somali pirates. Well, I guess to equate them, but not really. But it is this thing about naming, but it's hard to break that habit, you know, when that, those are the words that you see and, you know, around the subject all the time.
And Alexandra, thank you for the call. You, by the way, we went to the break and you were starting to say something more about, you know, warning new moms, and I wanted you to finish that thought.
Oh, we were talking about whether you really can card your children permanently. I'm not talking to, you know, the person who's locking their child in the closet. I'm really talking to you like your basic parent. And I really do think that what ends up happening is we get so terrified that we're going to do something that's going to cause lasting damage. You know, we're going to not play the Baby Einstein video often enough, and that's going to, or we're going to play the Baby Einstein video, and that's going to cause lasting damage.
Excuse me, can you still recite Lion King by heart? Speaking about playing the video.
Much of it. My Swahili is kind of iffy nowadays, though.
I think Swahili is not right. Ree, I think it's on point here. Go ahead, Ree. You're on.
Hi. Do you mean Lee?
Lee, I'm sorry. It says Ree on my screen. Kevin wanted you to get an R rather than an L.
I just wanted to ask Ms. Wald. you know, most parents are not playing Mozart to their pregnant stomachs 24/7 and being, you know, hyper-vigilant.
Thank God.
You know, as you're describing, and I think your remarks are a little bit reactionary. And I understand why, because I have felt that way, too, that sometimes parents are overweening and there's just too much hovering going on in general. But having just graduated my son from high school successfully after, you know, lots of caretaking and worrying and hand-wringing, you know, I'm really ready for him to leave. And a lot of us feel this way. And we're not sitting around, you know, worrying about what we're going to do after they go. And, you know, generally I think most people have a pretty reasonable attitude toward their children. But this notion that you can't damage your children is just fatuous. I'm sorry, but I have seen lots and lots of damage done among my peers. And
it's always easy to say that other people are damaging their children, isn't it?
Well, you talk about the bad mother police force. But
exactly.
You see mothers sometimes hectoring kids and yelling
I'm
and screaming at them.
That. I'm saying we can all damage our children. Yeah. I mean, it's not a matter of they versus us or that I'm doing better than my neighbor.
Well, but it is, isn't it? Isn't it really a matter of you doing better? Because you're saying we can all damage our children, you're saying, but I haven't damaged mine. I've successfully sent mine off to high school.
Sure.
But you've damaged yours, my friend, with your hectoring.
I'm sure I've damaged mine in ways that I probably don't even know. I mean,
and are they damaged or are they good? Are they fine? Are they damaged?
We all do the best we can.
That's the point of the book. We all do the best we can, and we need to lay off ourselves and lay off each other and stop feeling so guilty and ashamed.
It's not the case that you can't. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to do better. Okay.
Well, I don't think there's any argument with you on that score. But I think I understand where she's coming from. The idea that, you know, parents can be disapproving, they can be withholding, you know, they're human beings, and that can do damage.
I mean, you know, yes, of course. And if you drop your baby on your head, you can damage it. But the truth is that the vast majority of people are doing just fine. I mean, the person who's beating herself up the most about the damage she's doing to her kid, I promise you, is one of the people who's doing the least amount of damage. And we're so – there was at the beginning of school this year, we're sitting in parent-teacher the sort of back-to-school night, and – it was second grade, and people were talking about their kids reading or not reading. And one of the moms started saying, well, you know, you have to do this and this to make them read because you can cause them permanent damage if you don't, you know, do this and this in such a way. And I, you know, it was our first day at the school.
It's hyperbole.
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, if you try to do your best, if you try and if you acknowledge your mistakes and you apologize for them, then really they're going to be fine.
I want to go to some...
Or if they're not, it's probably not your fault, you know?
I want to go to some emails here. Kevin says, same with walking or learning to talk. We over-worry about when they do it. I think that's right. In fact, people, they look at their APGAR test now, you know? They get a higher APGAR test.
10 APGARs,
than the baby
right.
Next to me. How much of your writing was influenced by Anne Lamott? And by that, I mean, you took over for her in Salon.com. Mm-hmm. She was... You know, neuroses on the table, and here I am, you know, almost ad nauseum sometimes. I mean, was that...
Well, her book was a real epiphany for me in terms of my mothering. When I read Operating Instructions, I just thought, amen, sister, finally someone really talking about the way it is. And that whole Kate Moses, the website that they had on Salon, Mothers Who Think, was wonderful. You know, and the title was always facetious because, you know, most mothers think.
As was the Dead Baby Club, by the way, which
yes.
you mentioned here.
Yes.
Some people would probably find that off-putting. You could understand.
Yeah, probably not someone who's gone through the experience. That kind of black humor was really what got us. You know, I have this group of friends. We call ourselves the Dead Baby Club. We all met through support groups, and that and that kind of horrible dark humor that makes you people uncomfortable makes us uncomfortable. It was really one of the ways that we healed. But yeah, I love Anne Lamott. I think she's just terrific. And I definitely felt like it was liberating to read her. And I thought, you know, yeah, you can say, guess what? You can say stuff. You can just say it. And, you know, nothing happens except maybe you make people laugh.
Well, here we go to some of our listeners. Terry writes, by the way, she says, I follow you on Twitter. Love your tweets. Oh, I graduated a year before you.
I love Twitter. I was so down on Twitter in the beginning. I couldn't figure out why I needed to Twitter. But I love
why
it now.
Why you needed to tweet.
Tweet. Why I needed to tweet, yes. But first of all, it's amazing. And we can talk about the whole thing that's going on with the Iran
yeah,
stuff.
We could do a whole hour on that. But yeah. she asking for some sage advice.
Oh, wait, sage advice. Okay.
She says, I graduated a year before you from Harvard Law School and long to leave the practice of law to write. I blog, I'm working on a novel, and I've won a few local short story contests. How did you transition from practicing law to writing for a living, and when did you feel you were good enough at writing that you could make a living at it?
I am a terrible example. I am a terrible example. It's so unfair for me to even give any kind of advice, so I won't. All I will say is that I completely cheated. My first murder mystery was the first creative writing I ever did, other than, you know, sentencing memoranda, trying to convince the judges that my clients were decent people who should be let out of jail earlier. And I have a husband who had an agent. That's really all it came down to. So that when I wrote this book, he could call his agent and say, Ayala wrote a novel and you have to read it. And she could say, oh,
you also
great.
Had a husband who did a lot around the house and who was not yeah. only doing a lot around the house, a Jewish man who was handy.
Yes,
which is a very
I know.
Unusual
right, huh?
combination.
I still can't get used to that.
Here's Kelly who writes, since Ms. Waldman seems so willing to write about and discuss hard personal decisions and their consequences, I'm curious to know whether she's written about any feelings she has about the environmental impact of bringing four children into the world. And what if each of them has four children? Beyond her own personal feelings, does she think this topic is one that can ever be openly addressed in our society without fear that we'd be heading towards the kind of restrictive policy that exists in China?
You know, Abraham was a delightful accident. And but when I found out I was pregnant, I had this incredible zero population growth, hysterical, you know, what have I done to the environment? And I can't remember any of the research, but basically I was encouraged by a number of studies, surely specious, but I don't care, that basically said that that in the United States, we don't have the same issue, although we do consume, you know, so many resources. I don't know. I'm really sorry. I wish I could say that I was, you know, a good enough person to consider all that. But, you know, I really love my kids and I love having a big family. But I'm happy to condemn people who have five children. I'll do that on, you know, for
the
cause.
Another listener says, in case your guest wonders why some might be offended by her statement that she loves her husband more than her children, consider that it may be because of the completely unnecessary, perhaps even damaging idea of quantifying her love as the next step to state which of her children she loves more.
Well, the essay is a response to the quantifying. The essay says, look, if we are making hierarchies here, and this is what I see happening, women are very – the women in, you know, that I see in these gymboree classes are very clearly making a hierarchy, and the hierarchy goes child, spouse, and then you last probably. Then if that's the game we're playing, then you've got the hierarchy wrong, and my hierarchy is different. So it's not like I'm saying, you know, let's all sit down with a calculator and figure out exactly what percentage of love we're going to give here or there. It's, you know, it was a response to a social phenomenon.
A couple more emails before I go to more of your calls. Here's a listener who says, have you made a connection between your working while hubby MC took care of kids, helping to keep your passion for your husband primary? I see the connection. As the main caregiver, I don't find I have much left over, whereas what I do with baby makes hubby more passionate for me. I didn't mean to give all the passion of baby, but it seems like a natural thing that happens if one person is doing all the housework and baby work.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's really what I say in the book. That's what this book is about. This book is about that whole idea that if you are solely responsible for the domestic sphere, whether you work outside the home or not, it is it can be incredibly demoralizing. And like I said, I'm sure there's someone's going to call and say, I am completely fulfilled by staying home with my kids and being entirely responsible. I'm a Caitlin Flanagan, completely fulfilled in all ways by being home with her kids.
But you know what the key was to me in reading your book? Understanding how close you were with your mother and how much she helped shape your destiny and have an effect on your character logically. And you said at one point early on in the book, if she had read Kate Millett, her whole life would have been different.
Absolutely. And, absolutely. I mean,
and like
you know,
so many women of that generation.
She really would. And I really do think that the reason, like what I say is the reason I love Michael so much is not because I have some deep, profound insight into, you know, what marriage means. It's because the man pulls more than his weight around the house. So I don't have to spend any time resenting him. And I think there's a huge...
Doesn't it help that he's got a Pulitzer Prize?
Yeah, I loved him before the Pulitzer Prize. I really do. You know, I think that that load you drag around of like, you know, the guy comes home at 7:30 at night and says, wait a minute. I just need an hour to decompress before I deal with the kids. You know, who could possibly be sexually attracted to someone when you're bearing that much resentment? And that's what I tell all these guys who email me. They say, oh, how can I make my wife more like you? And they obviously don't mean how can I make my wife bipolar with too big a mouth and too chubby and all that. They mean, how can I get some action? And I always say, you know what? Unload the dishwasher.
But
do a load of laundry.
You write about decreases in libido. I mean, you know, Nobody should get the emphasis here that, you know, you're concupiscent all the time.
No, I had,
like
you know, I breastfed one kid till he was almost
three.
Should
I have used that word, concupiscent?
It's a good word. You have to build up the vocabulary of the listening
public.
Yeah,
but then people will say, why do you use those big words? All right, here's Emily who writes, I embrace the author and her bad mother term of sarcasm, but many of these new bad mother websites talk about literally bad mother actions that border on child abuse. And they're now proud of these things. I laud talking about not overscheduling your kids, not spoiling them, et cetera, but when you brag that you are leaving your infant unsupervised in the bathtub, someone needs to point out that they shouldn't be bragging about that, that they need to be responsible adults.
Yeah, you're probably right. I don't think it's a good idea to leave. Well, I once ran out of the room I had the two kids in the tub, and I thought the three-year-old was old enough, and I went to get a towel or something, and I heard this kind of glug glugging, and I ran back, and the baby was drowning, and my older daughter said, I said, why didn't you call me? And she said, I did call you very softly. So yeah, don't leave your kid alone. And there was this one website that someone forwarded me a link to, this homeschooling mother of nine who had an infant. And she had a back scratcher, and she said that was the tool that she used to hit her infant. So, yeah, you know, bad idea. Person hitting a baby with a back scratcher, probably we need a little intervention.
We'll do some damage there, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if she'll even do some damage. It's not like beating him to death. But, you know, he's not going to like her very much when...
From Santa Rosa, Paul, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, this is... I have a somewhat unusual situation. I married a woman who had three kids. The middle one was 10 years old with Down syndrome. And he's 30 years old at this time. The reason that I married her is that she insisted on taking full responsibility for the children. And I have since then pitched in. We share the responsibilities. But she, at the time she had him, it was not possible to know in advance whether you would have a Down's child. She has advised person after person after person who has asked her whether they want to keep or have this Down child that they know is coming to experience what it's like to have one. She said, you can borrow mine for a few days. In other words, before making that decision, it shouldn't be vicarious. I think it's important that someone take the time to actually experience what it's like to have one. They are they're loving, and they are unique, and you learn tremendously from them what makes you work, but at the same time it is an extremely large burden that goes on for the rest of your life.
Well said. Thank you so much for the call, Paul. I'll just move on to another call. I think that speaks for itself. We'll go to Berkeley. Jessica, hi.
Hi there. I want to say that I'm really enjoying the conversation. I love when people have no boundaries, even if I'm not at that place myself. And I wanted to share an experience that I had when I was about 5 years old. I'm 27 now. And I remember playing in the living room with my sister and my family and asking my mom, you know, who do you love more, me or me and my sister or my dad? And she said, your dad. And I remember kind of being like, oh, okay, well, there's that, you know. But it made sense to me, and I've obviously remembered it over these years. And I just want to say that I think it's a really natural thing, and I think it's good for the kids to hear that.
Thank you, Jessica.
Yeah, Jessica, thank you for the call. Actually, it brought to mind something that I was way in the recesses of memory. My parents used to say, well, what would you do if you were on a lifeboat and you could only save one person, your mother, your father, or your wife?
It's a Jewish thing to do.
I'm thinking.
Oh, they're asking you to decide?
They're asking me to decide. I don't have a wife. No wife is on the horizon. I'm 14 years old or whatever. And I said, I don't know how to answer that question. And they said, no, there's a right answer. Okay, what's the right answer? The right answer is your wife, because your parents have done their job. They've given birth to you, and now it's time for you to carry on progeny of your own and populate the world and all that sort of thing.
And
it had a lasting effect, too.
It's completely insane, but it's lovely.
Some people come by their insanity through heritability. Dan, hi, you're on the air. Good morning. Dan, are you there? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate the guest approach to the abortion debate. I just wanted to mention, I walked into the UCSF bookstore a couple of years ago, and my mom was dying in the hospital, and went to the embryology section to see what the science behind it said on whether the embryo was alive or not. And to a T, all of them in the bookstores said that human life begins at conception. So just in terms of adding to the debate that the guest was talking about, in terms of honesty and starting from the right starting point, I just wanted to make sure that's not a God question. It's not a religious question. The science is complete on it. It's been complete for decades. It's in the books, and I wanted the conversation to start there going forward. So I appreciate the show.
Appreciate your call, Dan. Response, Ayelet?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, you know, it is life in the sense that it is, has the potential to become a human being. I always found that debate sort of silly. When does life begin? I mean, that's not really the discussion. It's when does that life take precedence over the host is the question, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, when can you force a person to incubate another life? And I think that's really the relevant question. And that's why I think viability relieves the burden, because once the baby is viable or the fetus is viable, then it's easier to say, well, you know, this being can exist on his or her own and thus has, you know, rights that we're willing to discuss. And I think that, I mean, that for me, that's a very comforting, viability has always been a very comforting notion. And what's interesting about the science is that no matter how much advances in neonatology, no matter the progress, we've been able to keep the health and babies who are born earlier and earlier healthy and keep them alive, many with problems, obviously. But there does seem to be this line beyond which we're never going to go. And so I think, you know, as lawmakers who need bright lines, that's a good one.
There's a listener named Laverne who says, I have to disagree, that safe from abuse, no mother can damage their children, and years of therapy have proven that to me. My mother had me when she was 15 years old. And by the way, let me just digress here for a moment. You mentioned at one point in the book that Michael was the first person since the age of 15 that you didn't sleep with on the first date, which is quite
a
public.
Oh my God, you just told that to my kids. Oy.
Well, I thought about that when I read it. I thought, you know, you're going to go through this early teenage stuff.
They don't read anything I write. No, that's okay. Now I have to explain to my daughter another thing. Mommy made terrible mistakes.
Well, that's going to be a tough one. I'm sorry. I didn't know they were listening.
No, it's okay. Can I just...
Michael Lewis's daughter emailed when he was on, by the way.
Oh, really? I mean, his children obviously care more about him than mine do about mine. They just won't read anything. But I'm not the one saying that, you know, there's no way to damage your children. What I'm saying is that if you are a parent who cares, if you're the parent who's worrying, if you're the parent who's fretting, then you're really not going to do any harm. I mean, obviously within reason, but the kind of, you know, if I send my kid to the wrong school, or if I miss this, you know, moment of, like, you know, a couple of our kids have learning issues, and we were a year late on board, and I beat myself up I still beat myself up. Like, if we had just caught this earlier, his life would have been so much easier. But What my point is that kind of torturing of yourself ends up being more destructive than the thing that you're torturing your kid about. Now, obviously, you know, the people who are beating their children with back scratchers or, you know, dripping venom into their ears are probably not going to read my book because they don't care if they're bad mothers.
Well, let me I got straight here a little bit from the – I want to read this email, another one, because they're on the same thing. My mother had me when she was 15 years old, and there's not one moment that I don't think she should have had an abortion. I think her life would have been 100 times better had she not had me, then married a man whom she didn't love, who was also not my biological father, had two more children at a young age with never really growing up and becoming a loving, caring, responsible mother. Besides my mother, I ended up having a lovely childhood with grandparents who made up for what she lacked, but never once has my mother not resented me or caused me emotional distress. And there's another listener who says, as a child with three siblings and many different parents, I know that parents can do lots of lasting harm to their children without any physical violence whatsoever. My favorite birthday card we all received at least once, happy birthday, I wish you had never been born, love, Mom. And she wasn't kidding.
Right. Of course. Really, seriously, people, I am not here saying that nobody can emotionally damage their children. Of course you can. But what I'm saying is that the kind of things that we worry about, the people who care about their kids and are worrying about, you know, whether or not they're feeding them things with partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, need to chill out. That's all I'm saying.
A lot of those in Berkeley, aren't there?
Yes, many.
Let's take a quick call here, and we'll get you on from New Milford, Connecticut. Julie, hi.
Hi, how are you? Ayelet, I just wanted to say I met you online years ago through the online chat group Pump Moms.
And hey, how are you?
Hi, good, how are you? Our children are about the same age, and Pump Moms, for those who don't know, it's a group for moms who need to express breast milk because their children can't nurse, won't nurse, or whatever.
There's a whole chapter about that in her new book,
yes.
By the way, yeah.
I love those Pump Moms. They were awesome.
It's a fantastic resource. But you were a great help to me, and I think I was somewhat of a help to you because your son could not nurse. My child would not nurse. And I think something you were alluding to earlier is that children sort of come out born with their personalities ready to go. My child refused to nurse for about 4 months and then decided it was okay. And that's sort of how she's tackled every single problem.
Forgive me, Julie. I'm just going to have to jump in here because we're at the end of the hour. But I thank you for calling. And again, there's a whole chapter on that breastfeeding. In fact, you can find out all about Ayelet Waldman's Rack as well if you read the book.
Oh, my Lord.
That's all in there. Sorry. You've had fun this hour, though, haven't you?
I have. It's been very fun. It used to be a really good rack, I will say that.
Yeah, you
four
did say
children,
that. And again,
what are you going to do?
Meet the author.
Welcome to Undergarments.
Shining your shoes. You can meet the author, by the way, tonight at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley. Thank you for being with us for this hour of Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.